Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
This evening we'll be looking at 1 Samuel chapter 13, quite a big shift from where we started with Judges 19 and 21 Judges 19 and 21, the demise really of the period of the judges when Israel was looking not like a holy nation set apart, called by God, but rather as a nation that was just like every other nation, if not worse. And then we saw the beginning of 1 Samuel with the prayer of Hannah, and then the household of Eli, the rising of Samuel with his little ephod and serving the Lord in the presence of the Lord, him rising and becoming a prophet, the stolen ark, the fall of Eli's household, the height of chapter 7 when Israel was worshiping God truly. They put away all their other foreign gods and actually turned and served the Lord only. And then chapter 8, they ask for a king. And we've been looking at this transitionary period where they go from the period of, or the era of judges, to the rise of King Saul. We saw the king anointed, Saul anointed, him proclaimed, him renewed. And then last week we looked at the warning from Samuel. And we've seen some patterns, haven't we? We've seen some patterns where Hannah and Samuel serve the Lord and have a heart for God. And we've seen some bad patterns, these contrasts, these opposites of Peninnah and Hannah in the first opening chapter, and then Hophni and Phinehas and Joel and Abijah. And they don't have that heart for God, that contrast. And we've read this story before. We know where this is going. It's not new to us. Even if we're just read the Gospels, where people see Jesus, they cry out, "Son of David, not son of Saul." We know the direction this is kind of going. And we've taken a few notes along the way. We've noted things about Saul that have been pointed out or emphasized, that he's from the tribe of Benjamin, that terrible, horrific tribe, which was in Judges 19 and to 21, not only the tribe of Benjamin, but from Gilgal, the actual people that knocked on the doors demanding this horrific act. And we've seen this outward appearance, not often that the Bible goes into detail about outward appearance, but very frequently it's mentioned that he's tall, he's handsome. Really the people's choice for a king, which is really what they wanted. Although it was elected by God, this is exactly what they wanted. They want a king like other nations. But tonight we see the change, and a clear change in the narrative. So far, we've taken notes about Saul, but really we don't know exactly what the author thinks about Saul specifically. The kingdom now is established, and Samuel has given his warning. And the very last two verses of chapter 12 says, "Only fear the Lord and serve him faithfully with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. But if you do wickedly, you shall be swept away, both you and your king." And there's a divide here with chapter 12 and chapter 13 in our Bibles, but there's no divide when it comes to the story. It just flows. There's no chapter divisions in the Hebrew manuscript. And both you and your king. Now we turn to chapter 13. And the first section we'll look at is fighting in verses 1 to 5. But we're going to spend a bit of time on verse 1. The ESV translates this: "Saul lived for 1 year and became king, and when he had reigned for 2 years over Israel." That's what the ESV writes. But the early ESV in the 2007 edition says Saul was blank years old when he began to reign, and he reigned blank and 2 years over Israel. The New King James says Saul reigned 1 year when he had reigned 2 years over Israel. And I didn't think I had that written down, but I got a New King James from the library. And there's a footnote in this version of the New King James, and it says this in the footnote for verse 1. The Hebrew is difficult. The Hebrew is difficult, and that is very true. It's hard to really narrow down. Young's literal translation is an older translation that just tries to literally translate very wooden, and that says, a son of a year, and then they put in the word is Saul in his reigning. Yea, 2 years he hath reigned over Israel. If I was to woodenly translate this verse, it would be Saul lived one when reigned, and 2 years reigned over Israel. That's kind of how it is written. Maybe this might then be a reference to Saul was very immature. It's very unlikely that he's ahead above everyone else when he's one. But I mean, even a one-year-old is not had their birthday. That might be 18, 19 months old. But still, a two-year-old that is ahead above everyone else is very unlikely. So maybe it's just a reference to his maturity levels. But most likely, it's unlikely that Saul would have been 30 years old. Some translations try and put in that he was 30 years old when he began to reign. If he reigned for 40 years, which we find from Acts 13:21, then he asked for a king, and Saul gave him Saul, the son of Kish, the man of the tribe of Benjamin, for 40 years. There's kind of three possibilities when we look at this first section of verse 1. He was 1 year old when he began to reign. He was 30 years old, or he was somewhere in the middle. There's your options. Again, we turn back to that footnote. Hebrew is difficult. This really can be a question then of timeline. If this is a standard introduction to a kingship, we see this pattern throughout Chronicles. We see this pattern throughout Kings and even 1 Samuel. Introduction and conclusion into the king's reign. This is the opening of his kingship. Now we've seen this transition actually happen. Now we are actually into the kingdom of Israel rather than this period from between judges to kings. So why is this important? Some scholars might come to this and then speak of editors and pseudo-authors that come in and they just did a terrible job of editing when they were piecing together all these pieces of the puzzle, and they've just done a terrible job editing. I think that we need to understand that 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel cannot be written all by Samuel, because Samuel dies at 1 Samuel 25. So then how does he edit after he's passed away? But the role of a prophet was actually not just to proclaim the word, but also to write it down and to have an account of that. That's why when we turn to the prophets, who wrote Ezekiel? Ezekiel wrote Ezekiel. We can look to that. So the role of a prophet was to write it down. So if you turn to 1 Kings 29:29, it actually says, "And the acts of King David and from the first to the last are written in the chronicles of Samuel the seer, and in chronicles of Nathan the prophet, and the chronicles of Gad the seer." So all these accounts are written down. So who wrote 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel? I think these three men, Samuel, Nathan, and Gad. And so we have this understanding here. So come to this verse. It's very, very difficult. Some people might put this down to an error in human transmission in the text. And I think that might be a valid point to make, that although this error might have come in, that it's still there, that we don't have a perfect text that is handed down specifically from God. We can see the transmission of it throughout history. And that's actually a good thing when we think about the Bible. It's a good thing because when we look at something like the Quran, they actually went through and actually got rid of all the alternative texts. So there's only one authorized text. And that really doesn't do a good service when you go back to try and look at manuscripts. However, I just think it's complicated because it's just written like that. That's how Samuel, I tend to believe that it's kind of emphasizing Saul's immaturity here, that he was young, he was immature when he became king. So, that is verse 1. As that footnote said, Hebrew is difficult, and this verse is difficult as well. But now we turn to the rest of that first section in fighting, so verses 2 to 5. Saul chose 3,000 men of Israel, 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash, in the hill country of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gilboa in Benjamin. And the rest of the people he sent home, every man to his tent. Jonathan defeated the garrison of the Philistines, that was at Geba, and the Philistine heard of it. And Saul blew the trumpet throughout the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." And all of Israel heard it, said that Saul had defeated the garrison of the Philistines. And also Israel had become a stench to the Philistines. And the people were called out to join Saul at Gilgal. And the people, the Philistines, mustered to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen and troops like the sand on the seashore in multitude. They came up and encamped in Michmash at the east of Beth Aven. So Saul chooses 3,000 men to be able to help him conquer this enemy. He chooses 3,000. He gives 2,000 to himself and he gives 1,000 to his son Jonathan. And then he sent others home. Now, maybe we don't necessarily know this for sure, but maybe this was a bad idea. One commentator says Saul took command of the larger force, sent 2,000 men and stationed them at Michmash, which is a modern Michmash, about 4.5 miles northeast of the capital of Gilboa. The location was strategic since it was near the crucial pass by the way of Orpah, a road in Israel's central highlands that led to Gilboa. Saul's firstborn son, Jonathan, was given command of the remaining men who were stationed in Gilboa in Benjamin. And this is Israel's capital at the time. So just the location, Saul is trying to be strategic a little bit. However, it's not Saul that defeats the Philistines, it's his son, Jonathan. And he does so with less men. Now, we've seen this before, that it's not necessarily the patterns in which these battle plans which come with the Israelites that then lead to their victory. It's the Lord working within them to be able to use whatever means he uses to be able to conquer his enemy. It's not that these battle plans work. I mean, taking the ark into the middle of the battle in 1 Samuel 5 wasn't necessarily a great plan. But we see maybe the Lord's hand is with Jonathan and not with Saul. But Lord's using Jonathan there. And the Philistines heard about it. So how does Saul then react to this situation? He blows a trumpet. And to us, we read this and what does this actually mean? We get out a trumpet. It doesn't necessarily mean something today, but it's a very specific thing in Israel to actually blow a trumpet. In Numbers 10, 1 to 10, it actually explains these different types of things that you do when you blow a trumpet. He tells Moses, Lord tells Moses, say, make two silver trumpets. And then when both are blown, all the congregation shall gather themselves at the entrance of the tent of meeting. But if they blow only one, then the chiefs and the heads of the tribes shall gather themselves to you. So this is like a warning system that's in Israel at the time. But if the sons of Aaron, the priests, shall blow the trumpets, the trumpets shall be for you a perpetual statute throughout your generations. And when you go to war in your land against your adversary who oppresses you, then you shall sound the alarm with the trumpets, that you may be remembered before the Lord your God, and you shall be saved from your enemies. So there's a specific thing. So there's these two reasons that Saul could be blowing the trumpet to be able to get the chiefs and the tribes to go there to be able to do this offering, or to be able to go to war. So why does he blow this trumpet? Is it for war or is it for an offering? In verse 4 it said, "And all of Israel heard that Saul had defeated the garrison of the Philistines. Now, this is a false claim. Saul did not actually do it. If you remember, Jonathan actually defeated this garrison. But we'll quick to note that Saul lives off other people's success very frequently. So they now Israel had become a stench. Now, Jonathan with his 1,000 men had gone in to conquer. And now Israel is now a stench to the Philistines. This word is used when the Nile stinks in Exodus chapter 7. So you think about the smell of rotting flesh or rotting fish. And this is what the Israelites are to the Philistines. So they all go then to Gilgal. And in verse 8 it says, "You go before me to Gilgal, and behold, I'm coming down to you." This is verse chapter 10, verse 8. Samuel speaks to Saul and tells him to go down before me to Gilgal, and behold, I'm coming down to offer burnt offerings, to sacrifice peace offerings. 7 days you shall wait until I come to you and show you what you shall do. So this is why verse 1 can be interesting. This period of time, this transition period that we've been looking at, could just be a section within a week of this time from verse chapter 10, when Saul is anointed as king. Samuel gives this direct command to him to go and wait there 7 days and I'll come and make an offering. Quite a simple instruction when we looked at this. You wait 7 days and then I'll come and make an offering. If you then turn to verse 1 and you look at this as a period of time in your timeline, that 2 years has passed, then this would be a different situation to what it is. I tend to believe that that's an introductory comment that leads to the opening of Saul's kingship, but not necessarily within this timeline of the narrative which is unfolding. So he tells him to wait 7 days. So is Saul blowing this trumpet for an offering, or is Saul blowing this trumpet for war? I tend to believe it's probably for the offering side of things, although it's not necessarily directly clear. So he goes to Gilgal to make an offering. Saul had thought he had won the battle, maybe as a celebratory offering, giving thanks to the Lord, maybe a little bit of pride. Maybe he doesn't understand the enemies that are before him. But then the Philistines mustered a fight with Israel. Now, 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, troops like the sand of the seashore, and a multitude. They came and encamped at Mishmash. This is where Saul was, and east of Beth-Aven. So, remember how many Saul chose to be with him? 3,000. So now, you have at least 36,000 people coming and attacking your 30,000 men. And that's not even accounting for all those foot soldiers, the troops that were there like the sand of the seashore. So you're outnumbered 1-7, basically. So now they go from fighting to fleeing. We see this in verses 6-7. "And when the men of Israel saw that they were in trouble, for the people were hard pressed, they hid themselves in caves and in holes and in rocks and in tombs and in cisterns. And some Hebrews crossed the fjords of the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. Saul was still at Gilgal, and the people followed him trembling." What a difference a king makes. Now, can you remember back in chapter 7 when they're going to make an offering and the Philistines come and try and conquer them? And their response to Samuel is, do not cease to cry out to the Lord our God for us, that he may save us from the hands of the Philistines. So during this time when the Philistines are coming upon them, their faith is strong. They believe in what God has said. And they stand there while the Philistines are coming to attack them. But in this case, the difference, now the Philistines are coming, and what do? Instead of having faith, they have fear and they flee. They'll come back up as we read through the rest of 1 Samuel, but just a different contrast and a difference the leadership might make. So now we come to the third section, forced or foolish. Now this really is the key portion of this scripture in verses 8 to 14. I'll begin by reading verses 8 to 10. And he waited 7 days, the time appointed by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, "Bring the burnt offering here to me, and the peace offerings." And he offered the burnt offering. And as soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him and greet him. Now, remembering this verse from chapter 10, verse 8, which says, "And go before me to Gilgal, and behold," this is the instruction that Samuel gives. And amongst all these providences were happening in chapter 8, he gives them this very specific instruction to go there to Gilgal, wait 7 days, and I'll come and make an offering. So I tend to believe this is the exact same instance that Samuel was speaking about in verse 10, verse 8. So this period of 7 days, he's gone from being anointed to 7 days to now this instance happening in 7 days. Not a very large time span. "In 7 days you shall wait until I come to you and show you what to do." So Saul takes matters into his own hands. And we've seen this again, the issue in 1 Samuel chapter 4. They come before him and say, "What shall we do?" They don't go to the Lord. They don't try and find out the solution. What they do is they take matters into their own hands. And this is exactly what Saul starts to do. He then makes burnt offerings. He makes God a pagan God who responds with offerings and merely external actions. Again, they're trying to carry out what has done in the past to make them maybe the same outcome, but they're missing a key component, that God is the one that made the outcome. It's not the burnt offerings. It's not the ark. It's God making those things. So it's, but we looked, the providence that this happened, that they go over the mountain, they go over the hill, and then who's coming? Samuel's coming there, and he invites them to this meal in chapter 10 and chapter 9 and verse chapter 10. But the providence is God now flipped, and it's not into Saul's advantage. It's for God's glory. He walks in, and just as he makes his offering, just as he finishes this, Samuel comes. And Saul goes down to greet him. Maybe the image of walking in and the child, not just with their hand in the cookie jar, but their mouth full of cookies. He's been caught. You cannot cover that up. You can't blame your sibling for that. Or you can't explain this away. But Saul just seems oblivious to this action. Maybe he's just forgot what he has done, but comes in with a simple question. Samuel comes in with a simple question. "What have you done?" Again, questions are an opportunity for repentance. We've seen this in Genesis countless times. What have you done? Saul responds and says, "When I saw that the people were scattering from you and you did not come within the days appointed, and the Philistines had mustered at Mishmash, I said, 'Now the Philistines will come against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the favor of the Lord.' So I forced myself and offered the burnt offerings." Just like Adam and Eve blamed others when given this opportunity to ask questions, Saul points at other people. He blames the people scattering. He blames that Samuel was late. He blames the Philistines were mustering. He blames all these things. But he assumes the providence of God on his own actions. He forgets the warning from Samuel less than a week before. "Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart. For consider what great things he has done for you." Just in that chapter before, right before we get into chapter 13, this is the warning that Samuel gives. And Samuel, again, is short and succinct in his response in verse 13. And Samuel said to Saul, "You have done foolishly." Now, I think maybe some things maybe to stop and consider and ponder. How often do we, you and I, do the opposite of what God tells us to do or warns us within 7 days? How quick are we to point the finger, to blame others? How quick are we to push into a corner and respond out of fear rather than faith? We will see this again. We don't hear God, we hear others. This is something that's going to come up again in just a couple of chapters, actually. But this is not a moral story that teaches us to be moral people. Don't be like Saul. Be like Samuel. This actually shows the king that the people actually want. The king that even you and I want in our own lives, that looks exactly like everyone else. We will be the ones that tremble. We will be the ones that follow a false king. Without the help of the Lord, we will follow sin blindly. But we turn not to Saul, not to just any mere man. We turn to Christ to lead us, to guide us. That He is the one that we look to. But he has not kept the command of the Lord. Saul did not do what he had been told by the prophet Samuel. "For Lord would establish your kingdom forever," is his response at the end of 13. "You have not kept the commandment of the Lord for which he commanded you. And the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever." In verse 14, "But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." It's this external thing, really, that Saul is done. It might seem a little bit harsh, you know, you're 7 days in on the job, and you just didn't follow a simple instruction, and now you're fired, you've lost your job forever. However, it's very clear that that's what the role of the king was to do. In verse 24, "Only fear the Lord and serve him faithfully," at the end of chapter 12. This is the role of a king, that he was to do that. "But if you still do wickedly, you shall be swept away, both you and your king." And here, he has done a wicked thing. He has taken his role, not as king, but taken things into his own hand. So, this external action, but really we see this inner thing. And we've seen this throughout 1 Samuel. We'll see it unpack as well. That it's, the Lord is seeking a man after his own heart. That really, it starts with the heart and then grows into fruit. It's not just that he didn't listen to God. He didn't listen to God because he didn't have a heart to listen to God. He didn't have a heart for the Lord. That Saul didn't love the Lord with his whole heart, soul, mind, and strength. But this flat thing told to Saul that your kingdom shall not continue. Remember this. We see these patterns again, as I've mentioned in 1 Samuel, that 1 Samuel 2:30, and the Lord, the God of Israel, declares to Eli, "I promise that your house and the house of your father should go in and out before me forever. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me. For those who honor me, I will honor, and those who despise me shall be lightly esteemed." That this is what happens. We've seen right there in chapter 2 the cracks in Eli's legacy, and now we're even seeing the cracks in Saul's reign, and within not even 7 days, we see the cracks in Saul's legacy. Saul and Samuel appear to be the only one that know about this conversation. It doesn't necessarily mention in the text. However, you cannot help but wonder when Saul comes over to Samuel comes over and says, "Can I speak with you just for a minute on this hill?" Did Samuel speak like Moses when he came down from the mountain and he had thrown the tablets on the ground? Was he just so shocked at Saul making this burnt offering? Or was there Saul and he asked him to speak with him briefly? But we'll see this as well when we go through even Jonathan. It does appear that Jonathan does have a heart for God. So why wouldn't you just keep the line in Saul's name, but then shift it to Jonathan? It seems that Jonathan would make a very good godly king. We'll see this throughout. Jonathan is a very faithful, godly man. But Jonathan would not want to be king because the Lord has not chosen him to be king. It's a very clear thing. If he wanted to be king and the Lord hadn't chosen him, he wouldn't be a godly man. So there's this spiral which goes. I think Jonathan's a great person, that maybe one of those unsung heroes throughout this book. He humbly serves God through wherever he is called. But there's a single reason why his house will not be king forever. Because Saul did not keep the commandment of the Lord, even just a simple command. He was impatient. He was fearful. Maybe all these things got the best of him, but he did not. Saul was appointed to be a king, not a priest, and not even a prophet. He was appointed to be a king over Israel. So I think it's important that he's stepping outside of what God had allotted him to be able to do, what God had appointed him to be able to do. And he carries out this burnt offering because of all this noise and clutter around him. So now, this forced or foolish, again, he said that he was forced to do this. I think it was Samuel actually explains, "You were foolish in what you have done." So we go from foolishness now to the foes and forts in verses 15 and 18. "And Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal, and the rest of the people went up after Saul to meet the army. And when they went up from Gilgal to Gilboa and Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people who were present with him about 600 men. And Jonathan and Saul and Jonathan his son and the people who were present with them strayed till Gilba of Benjamin. But the Philistines encamped at Mishmash, and the raiders came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned towards Orpah, to the land of Shual, another company towards Beth-Thorhorn. Another company turned towards the border that looks toward the valley of Zeboiim, towards the wilderness." But Samuel leaves after this confrontation. He steps up and walks away. But now they have 600 men. So we go from 3,000 at the opening of the chapter. Now they have 600 men. That is 1 to 60 at a ratio. So every one Israelite, there's 60 Philistines. And the Philistines are at Mishmash, not on the edge of Israel, which you might think. They're right in the middle of Israel. They're not just creeping in on the side. They've taken over. And there's three companies, one looking to the north, one looking to the west, and one to the east. So now we go from bad to worse. They wanted a king, and this is the outcome which they've got. The word of God has moved away, but that's where they are. But not only do they have these issues with men, not having enough men, they've also got forgery problems. So there was no blacksmith to be found throughout all the land of Israel. For the Philistines said, "Lest the Hebrews make themselves swords and spears." But every one of the Israelites went down to the Philistines to sharpen his plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his sickle. And the charge was 2/3 of a shekel for the plowshares and for the mattocks, and 1/3 of a shekel for sharpening the axes and setting the goads. So, on the day of the battle, there was neither sword nor spear in the hand of anyone with Saul and Jonathan. But Saul and Jonathan, his son, had them. The garrisons of the Philistines went out to the pass of Mishmash. So, not only are they outnumbered, they have no weapons. What a battle it seems to be before them. They would have to travel to different country to sharpen their mattock. They wouldn't be able to do this. And who has a spear? Saul and Jonathan. You wonder who, how they got them. Was this actually theirs, or was this actually taken from them? Remember that warning that Samuel said, a king will take and take and take and take. So, this is the beginning of Saul's reign. We open up him actually as king, going through those three stages of anointing, of proclaimed, and then actually with the kingdom renewed. This is where we find ourselves at the end of chapter 13. We went from 3,000 men to 600 men. We went with an army of 1 to 60 compared to them. And we'll turn with the first half of chapter 14 with this very interesting situation we find ourselves in. But this is the kingship of Saul. This is really how we find ourselves. We've seen these glimpses that Saul wasn't necessarily the best king. These hints in this, the author of 1 Samuel, Samuel writing it, giving us hints that he really was not the right person. Obviously, the Lord is sovereign. The Lord is the one who selected him. We see the Lord using this to be able to hopefully teach us, but then also point us towards the king that we actually want. We don't actually want a king like Adam. We don't want a king like Saul. We want the second Adam. We want Jesus Christ as our king. And that's where we'll leave it for this evening.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.